Hi, and welcome to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. I'm your host, Nick Naughton, bringing you a special presentation from the 2019 IFPDA Fine Art Print Fair in New York City. The Printcast brings you interviews with some of the best contemporary printmakers, sharing anecdotes, business ideas, and technical tips with listeners everywhere. It's like print porn for your ears. I'm really excited today to bring you a special presentation from the fair, and they've been doing more programming this year. So this year they've had a number of different live discussions with master printers and artists and curators and just a lot of folks who give a good perspective on what the state of fine art printing is today, how the work is made, the relationships between artists and master printers, how to collect work, etc. And the talk today involves artist James Nares and his master printer, John Paul Russell, who he's been working with for almost two decades now. James Nares' work is basically some large-scale brush strokes, and they're very simple, very minimal. It's just like a blue brush stroke, right, on paper. And so we hear about in the talk how they go about making some of those, how the first ones were just maybe like six colors, but the newest ones that they're doing are 15 or more colors. And we're talking just like experimental screen printing with like different types of screen burnings. You get to hear about how they're making their screens, how they make the images, the relationship between the artist and printer. And all of this is facilitated by Phil Sanders, who's a former director of the Robert Blackburn Workshop and also a master printer himself. He's the husband of Ann Marshall, who's co-owner of Durham Press. John Paul Russell, who's also in this talk, is co-owner of Durham Press. So a lot of this kind of centers around one shop. They've been involved in the IFPDA for a long time, from what I can gather, and so it's very interesting, and they speak about print in very intelligent ways, and I really enjoyed hearing them talk and enjoyed listening back. You might hear a few points where you think they're going to go into talking about visual aids, but I tried to minimize that stuff and eliminated, you know, the spots where people are watching a video or something, so you're not kind of bored without the visuals. But overall, it's a really good discussion, so I hope you enjoy it. I wanted to bring up one announcement for today. There's a fundraiser that I think has maybe 2 weeks left called Let's Leave a Press in Puerto Rico. So if you want to find this, it's Indiegogo, Let's Leave a Press. Just Google that, you'll find it. And it's basically a really wonderful fundraiser, kind of geared around SGCI coming up in 2020 in San Juan, Puerto Rico. If you remember, of course, Puerto Rico got decimated by a hurricane over a year ago, so it's been quite a while. But like, because of a whole lot of reasons and a lot of politics and things that I don't need to get into that are disappointing as always, they basically don't have a whole lot of money to rebuild. And so things that were lost or damaged in the hurricane have yet to be replaced or fixed. And so from what I gather, there's just like a lack of equipment, a lack of supplies. And they're doing what they can down there, you know, with what they have. But like us all coming in a big group force down in 2020 will be a huge boon to their situation. It should be really fun to collaborate and meet everyone down there. And the locale is, of course, wonderful. Puerto Rico is amazing. One thing that Joe from Drive By Press put together is this fundraiser. So it's two parts. You can donate money. There's incentives, as always, like really wonderful prints that you can collect and things like that. But there's incentives, and we're trying to raise money to buy a printing press. What will happen is like the press will be down there, used for demos and different things during the conference, and then the press will stay. And it'll be like a long-lasting gift to the University of Puerto Rico, and it'll be basically it'll be a huge addition to the equipment available to students and artists down there. And the more money we raise, the more, you know, the bigger the equipment that will be purchased and taken there. So right now they've made partially, you know, a partway towards their goal, but it's definitely not enough to buy a decent sized press and to ship it and everything like that. So the other half of what they've done is they've started a registry, which I think is really brilliant. And it's basically for supplies and other things that are needed. So it's like you could literally buy tools, brayers, inks, additives, you know, every type of thing that people need in a shop. They kind of need everything down there. And of course, you can imagine it's not easy to buy things on Puerto Rico in general because it's an island and they don't just have Amazon shipping one day to like get every single thing they need. And check it out too, because the fundraiser has really incredible artworks. I saw, prints by artists that I've admired for many, many, many years, and they've donated them. They're being sold, and currently there's a whole lot of things available, and new prints are almost available every day. So please take a look. If you can't support it, share it, you know, let other people know that it's happening, because in a couple weeks it'll be done, and I'm sure they'll have to move on to the logistics of like figuring out like what can we get with the money we have, how are we going to get it there, etc. And so I encourage everyone to take part, contribute, because it does take a community, and we've got a strong one in the print world. So anyhow, hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I'll talk to y'all soon.
You're listening to The Printcast, a podcast about a dying art form finding new life, and the artists in the studio making it happen.
So an artist would do work on a print for a variety of reasons. One, they want to work in a medium that allows it to be disseminated to a larger audience. Another part of that process is to be able to see their own work taken apart and shown back to themselves, to learn more about their own creative practice and creative process. One of the amazing things about prints is that because they are in multiple, they can be disseminated in multiple places, and they have a higher likelihood of surviving. So we have a greater understanding of who we are today because we can understand who we once were.
Today on the Printcast, we're bringing you a special presentation from the 2019 IFPDA Fine Art Print Fair in New York. This year's edition took place in October of 2019. The IFPDA is an organization of expert art dealers who champion the work of artists in the artistic medium of print. Their annual print fair is the largest international art fair devoted to 500 years of fine art printing. Today on the podcast, we join a discussion called The Collaborative Process of Fine Art Printmaking, Phil Sanders, in conversation with James Nares and Jean-Paul Russell. James Nares is an English artist who's been working in New York since the 1970s. Nares has shown at Paul Kasman Gallery in New York, MoMA, the St. Louis Museum of Art, and the Tate Modern London. Nares' films, paintings, and prints are in the collections of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney Museum of Art, Chase Manhattan Bank, the Hood Museum, New Hampshire, and the Albright Knox Art Gallery. In discussion with Nares are Phil Sanders and Jean-Paul Russell. Sanders is the founder of P.S. Marlowe, a creative services consultancy firm focused on sustainable careers in the arts and cultural development through entrepreneurship and service. He was previously the COO of the Elizabeth Foundation for the Arts and director of the Robert Blackburn Printmaking Workshop. Jean-Paul Russell is co-owner and master printer at Durham Press in Durham, Pennsylvania. The Printcast recorded this episode on Friday, October 25th, in partnership with the IFPDA. Big thanks to everyone at the IFPDA and to Ann Marshall, James Nares, Phil Sanders, and Jean-Paul Russell for agreeing to share the audio today. Join me now live at the Javits Center in New York City.
My name is Ann Marshall. I'm the Vice President of the International Fine Print Dealers Association, and I have the pleasure of introducing a talk today. But before I do that, I wanted to just say that we're really proud to be offering a lot more programming here this year. After this talk, there's going to be a great talk with Helen Roslin, who runs the London Original Print Fair. Tomorrow, we're going to have talks with Jim Dine, Mel Bachner, and Matthew Day Jackson. But it's my pleasure to introduce today two people very close to me, my partner, Jean-Paul Russell, and Jamie Nares, along with Phil Sanders, who was the former director of the Robert Blackburn Gallery and is producing a beautiful book called Prints and Their Makers. And he's going to talk a little bit about his book. And then he's going to bring James and Jamie and JP on and talk a little bit about their working process together. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Uh,
As Anne said, I have a book coming out this time next year, pre-release over the summer, that really is an embodiment of what this fair represents. When you come to the IFPDA fair, it's kind of like walking into the back room of a museum. You get to see some of the most important historic works, and you get to see some of the most important contemporary works being made all in the same room. And for years, I've led a tour of this fair, a master printer's perspective of the fair, which over time evolved into this idea of explaining the collaborative process of printmaking as well as putting it in its historic context. And that's where this book, being published by Princeton Architectural Press, grew out of, was an outgrowth of this sort of a concept of the fair. And so one of the things I really talk about and was wanting to use as a setup for the conversation with Jamie and JP is this relationship of the artist, the printer, and the publisher. Any print that's being produced, that's being put out there and being sold, has these three parties involved. Sometimes one person wears all three hats. Sometimes one person wears two of those hats, or it's three individual people working together. But without the artist and without a printer and without a publisher, that work would never come into being or get to be part of the world. And one of the things that's so important about printmaking in order to realize that vision is the faith that's required and the respect and trust amongst those three parties in order to produce anything. Prints are really unique in the fact that if a publisher is wanting to put a print out into the world, they have to put their money up first. They have to pay for it to get it produced. So every one of the publishers here has put their money where their mouth is relative to the art. They know that that work is important. They know that that artist's voice has value, and they know that it's important for that artist's voice's value to be multiplied in the form of an edition. One of the things that's unique to print and is part of the historic canon of art and why we know so much about who we are as people today is because we know who we once were. And our printed record of images is one of those ways in which we find that out about ourselves. So an artist would do work on a print for a variety of reasons. One, they want to work in a medium that allows it to be disseminated to a larger audience. Another part of that process is to be able to see their own work taken apart and shown back to themselves, to learn more about their own creative practice and creative process, because they can see and maintain and hold the printed record. So a state proof, a part of the process of print and the process of working, you can go back and look at. So this example of Dürer's working process, an early state of Adam and Eve and a final state of Adam and Eve, allows us today to see what he was seeing at the same time he was in the production of that work. So we get a glimpse into what he was seeing, but we also get an understanding of how he may have approached that work of art. So many artists work in print to be able to get that non-biased, not subjected to the memory of an artist's working practice, placement of the prints in front of us. Publishers, historically, have had an important role in spreading the name of an artist. This is one of my favorite examples. Peter Bruegel, who's often known for his paintings, actually got a start as an artist doing engraving. And it was print work that allowed him to build a large enough name and a career to then function as a painter. So he only made 40 paintings, and they all came at the latter part of his life because prints are what allowed him to have his own market. So a publisher plays an integral role in spreading the work of an artist as well as their voice. And then there's the role of the printer. This is one of the more famous print collaborations that existed. This is Robert Blackburn on the left and Robert Rauschenberg on the right. And what they were doing at Universal Limited Art Editions in the early 1960s was helping printmaking be about creating a world versus recreating a world. And when we think about print, we really have those two approaches we can go to. You can either say, I have this idea and I want to replicate it in mass. Or you can say, I have a goal that I'm working towards and I don't know how I'm going to get there. I'm going to create the world as I go. And this print accident, which was a stone that was broken during the process of proofing. So Bob Blackburn broke that stone late one night out on Long Island at Universal Limited Art Editions. And as a printer, he felt devastated for destroying his artist's matrix. Rauschenberg came out in the morning, looked at it, and thought it was the greatest thing that had ever happened. And the reason was, it was unpredictable. And he was able to start from that point and move forward. Now, that's where the story normally ends with accident. What most people don't really talk about is in order for this to have actually happened, the continuation of a broken stone being printed, was the faith in the artist that the printer has that this is a good idea to move forward. And it was also the skill of that printer to be able to figure out a way to pull off printing a broken stone. And most people don't know that this is actually an edition of 29. That in and of itself, to get a few impressions is impressive, but to get 29 out of it is a printing feat. And so there's this balance. So if the printer didn't have the skill, the artist wouldn't ask, is this possible? And so this relationship between the printer
and the artist is one of mutual respect, not only for one another's quality of craft and craftsmanship, but also the reasons for being for that work to exist in the world. And so artists come into print studios at a variety of levels. So this is Josephine Halverson, who had never made an etching before, and she was invited to Wingate Studio, who are over at the EAB Fair, to work on her first etching. So coming in, she had no concept of the language of fine art printmaking. She was new to it. And so she needed to learn how to make it. And so in the process of making this work, there's lots of color tests that have to be done. The printers, Peter Pentengill and James Pentengill, had to teach her the language of print so that she could translate her mastery of paint and the movement of paint into a medium that was completely foreign to her. And what they ended up with was this intaglio. That was her first print. And so when you're working as an artist and you have that translator, it allows you to go from zero to 60 almost immediately. Other artists like Will Cotton here working at Flying Horse Editions are looking to push their creative practice further. They have experience, but they need to work with people to help them understand different ways of working. This is him working on a lithographic stone. And as you can see here, there's the stone in black. That's the first four layers in the middle and the final print on the right. So as an artist, he gets to see this process evolve. And we did this print, I did this with him, as a print-as-you-go process, meaning we print it on all the paper, we add the, he draws in response, we keep going. And so it's a building and an additive process. This is what it took to make it. Those are all the colors, those are all our notes. So this is the world that we live in as printers and help our artists inhabit. Other artists, like this project by William Kentridge, which was published by David Crute, are built off of an idea. This was an ephemeral project that was done as an installation piece, The Triumphs and Laments, in 2016 in Venice. It was a blackened wall from the soot and grime of the city that was used. The white is actually by power washing the wall clean. And this work will fade over time. It's expected to last for about 7 years. But the idea didn't end there. It came to, well, how do we translate this concept of something that was ephemeral into something that could last? And so the process was decided was woodcut, and the idea was to make it somewhat within this other large format scale, since the walls were in and of themselves about 20 feet tall. So in the studio, people have to translate the drawings, large format, takes many printers to do it. Wood blocks were made out of different materials to create different textures and zones. Several hands, it took about a dozen people, 4 years, to produce the 6 images in the series. Lots of additioning, lots of figuring out what parts go over and under to produce works such as this, which is Montaigne, which is one of the prints in that series. Other projects, this is a project with James Sienna that was done at Flying Horse Editions, are many years in the making. Artists often who work in a lot of processes have processes that they may not have an idea for, and it takes a printer and an artist coming together over periods of years to come up with a concept of something that is really different but also makes financial sense. And for James, he had never done monoprints before because it just didn't make financial sense for him relative to his working practice. So over time, what we decided was a consistent matrix that allowed for variation within. So each of these little pieces were hand-inked with watercolor, all pieced together in a large format matrix, run through a hydraulic press, stamped out to produce works like this, which was unique for his practice in a way that allowed him to have that tightness of his matrix or the design of his system, but have infinite variation within. So all of a sudden, monoprint now made sense for him. And when artists working in this sort of a way, this is a multi-year relationship. It took 14 years to come up with a project for him. Now, processes that have been around for a long time, say like dry point, which has been around since the late 1400s, are not processes that we get rid of in a contemporary sense. Printmaking has what we refer to as an additive toolbox. We have a technique, we keep it. We get a new technique, we add it into the box. So on the left, you've got a Rodin dry point of Victor Hugo, and on the right, you have a Julie Marotu dry point. Same technique, pieces of copper being scratched at directly by the artist to produce works that are representative of their time and those artists' particular vision, though it's the same process. And at other times, you can put works in a larger historic context. So on the left, you have Durer's Triumphal Arch, which is composed of 195 wood blocks. And on the right, you have William Kentridge's That Which I Do Not Remember, That Which I Do Not Remember, which was made up of 13 wood blocks. So the solution at arriving at a monumental scale work in the 1500s is a solution that's still just as effective at arriving at a monumental scale work today. It allows that work to be disseminated over time, and it allows this conversation to exist over time. So you can take the work on the left, which is about, you know, exalting Emperor Maximilian's reign, and you can take the work on the right, which is talking about the wreckage of those triumphs, of those victories. And that can now be shown in context because those works survive the test of time because they're in multiple. One of the amazing things about prints is that because they are in multiple, they can be disseminated in multiple places, and they have a higher likelihood of surviving. So we have a greater understanding of who we are today because we can understand who we once were. And that leads us to talking about James Narrows and Durham Press. So if you'd like to come on up.
We're going to watch quickly a film that my eldest daughter made. I was in the studio, and I wanted to record the process that I make what I call my high-speed drawings with. And I handed her the camera, a little Blackmagic pocket cinema camera, which she'd never used before. And I said, okay, get this shot here. And then, you know, she did that. And I said, okay, let's get this shot here. And she said, Papa, I got it. And she shot the film and edited it. And I was so proud.
Hi, I'm Jean-Paul Russell. And James and I have been working together for about 18, 19 years. And prior to this project, we'd been working a lot with his brushstrokes, which he's really well known for, making these complex, colorful screen prints. And James, as you just saw, had devised this drum, this lathe kind of drum, a way of making drawings, and had asked me kind of early on about the idea of helping him fabricate cones so he could make some curve drawings. And I did a bunch of research and kind of hit a lot of dead ends with fabricators to make them. And then about a year later, I thought, you know, I'll make the cones and we'll do a print project as a way to introduce the curved idea of what he's done here. So we work with a CAD guy out in Pennsylvania that helped us do the geometry. We came up with 9 different cones. Well, we made a drum and then 8 more cones with certain geometry that James and I talked about to get all the angles to go through each process. And then we had him do all the drawings, which we then sent to a guy that works for me who programmed it into a CNC. And then we made all the parts for each cone and glued them together. And then we attached the ribbing around that, covered it with a kind of a heavy screen door mesh, spackled the entire thing until they were flat multiple times, and then sanded them until they were smooth and perfect so that the drawings could be wrapped around them. And then I sort of built something similar to James, like a lathe apparatus that would hold each cone. Each one had its own set of bearings. And then we proceeded to pick a size and execute the drawings. The drawings were still an in-between to get to the print, which we decided to do in photogravure, which is a process with etching. So these are some shots. And so here's the actual plates that we got to. We had made 9, as I mentioned, and then James added an additional kind of angle to the plates to make them non-squares, to have them cropped, to give them even a further dynamic into the work. And then, as you saw with a lot of fill stuff, we proofed with color, experimented with different things, you know, cropping and all that, and came up with the basis for the project.
I have to say that I've been working with JP, as he said, for about 19, 20 years. And it's been such a treat, because every project that I come to you with entails some kind of reconfiguration of the whole idea of what we're doing. And JP, you're kind of a genius, the way you translate these things into a print. I wanted to make these cones because when I do the drawings, I don't know, there's something about a cone. I'm doing a straight line, but when we take the paper off, I have these beautiful curves, and that intrigues me in itself.
One of the things that really struck me when I was looking at the work for the first time was the dynamic nature of the mark making and how once it's the speed of that drawing process is translated into something that we can all consider to be relatively static as a piece of paper on a wall or in a frame, but how it holds that energy, and even in seeing just the parts and pieces, it allows us to in some ways connect that line. And I was really curious for you as to how that shape change from going from the very straight linear speed drawings into those curves may have filtered back into your studio.
Not yet, but I plan to make some paintings, probably with JP, in the my extended studio of the Durham Press. The cones that were made for this were works of art in themselves. It was so beautiful, and it seemed a pity not to use them for other things too. So I'm going to make some paintings with them. I was not capable of making these cones myself, so I'd always wanted to do these, but it took JP's know-how and touch to make it happen. They're amazing objects. We had to get them in the studio on a tractor, with forks. They were large and they move very fast. That's why, obviously, high speed. I've always, there's a lot of line in my work. There's a lot of movement. And with these, I wanted to, usually it's me moving. And with these, I wanted to have the drawing moving and myself standing still. So it's very much about touch. I make these, a line is like a little narrative always in itself anyway. There's a little kind of story etched in there or something musical. The nice thing about these lines is that they're never, they look like a straight line or a curve here, but they're never actually straight and they're never perfect and they never continue from one side of the drawing to the other. If you look at an angle, they're all slightly curved or vibrating like strings on an instrument, all just slightly curved. So there's a kind of a sonic touch to these as well.
One of the things that I would like you to maybe speak to, because you wear two hats in this kind of situation, you are all the printer as well as the publisher, and I'm really interested in how you arrive at the crazy projects you're willing to undertake. So when an artist comes to you and says, I've got this idea, and in their mind it may be one thing, and in your mind you're thinking, how am I actually going to make this happen? And I was kind of wondering if you could help some people understand how you navigate those two hats and that landscape as a printer and a publisher.
Well, I like to make complex prints in general, or complex projects. This project's kind of interesting because they're photogravures, so they're really one color plates. They're not overly complex. The actual printing is just a plate inked up, in this case, in a couple colors. So it's mixed on the plate and printed. But getting here, obviously, as you can see, was relatively complex. So it seems that when I don't have the complexity in the print, I find it somehow to put it in another way. So my approach with all the artists is to do what it takes to make something great. I sometimes think I'm not really a printmaker. It just happens to be in the way of what I'm trying to do with somebody. It happens to be the medium that I'm doing. But I like building and making things. So
it's, you like the path of most resistance.
Exactly. So prior to this project, we've been working for 17, 18 years making these complex multicolor brushstrokes, as I was saying before. And we have a history of making projects that have been successful. So this is a bit of a jumping off point in a lot of ways. But from a risk standpoint as a publisher, you never know if it's going to work as good as the last thing's working or you're doing a new thing. But for me, that's the exciting part. A lot of traditional publishers will make projects that they already know what the thing looks like. They want to publish a print with an artist of a certain kind of image and make it because they know it'll work and it might do well in the marketplace. But that's probably the least interesting thing for me to do. If you end up there with a really successful thing, amazing. But I love the idea of building the thing and making the thing and trying to come up with something that's new and interesting, both for the artist and for myself. And the process, the history of print, or adding something to it that will, really take it forward.
I would say every print that we've done together, you've come up with some extraordinary way to do them, because they're not easy things to make a print from. I have this work, I don't know if you know it, that I made with a machine that you paint the white stripes on roads with, like a line striper, it's called. And for those prints, we cast the original and then made a mold. I don't know. That was an extraordinary process, too. But I guess we're not talking about those. Okay.
We can talk about the relationship.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that really comes through for me in listening to the two of you speak is that the challenge to allow you to express yourself through whatever medium is the thing that drives the two of you the most, is that you have an idea or a jumping off point, and you have expertise and ideas that allow you to both go to places that you would not necessarily have thought you would go. And for me, I think from an outsider's perspective, it's one of the more enjoyable things is to see where you end up, knowing that this is yet again another jumping off point.
Yeah, likewise, we never really know where it's going to go, but there is a trust that we have from working together for so long. And I know the way he thinks, and he knows the way I think, and it really is a collaboration because, as you say, JP has this expertise of making prints, and I have whatever I have. And we kind of we usually bounce the things back and forth and see what is possible to do and what we want to do. And
so for you as a publisher, when you think of the body of work that you're making, do you often think about the previous project, or are you more generally absorbed in where you're going?
I think we're always reflecting on the previous project. Even when we're working with the brushstrokes, we always are evaluating what it is we did before, what could change size-wise or complexity. They've built up over the years. They started at 5 colors, then they went to 7, and then 9, and then 12, and then we did one at 15 different layers to make the combination of all the layers disappear by making the steps so small. And then with the road paint and this project, we decided in a weird way that we needed to kind of move on to something new, not that we would abandon the brushstrokes, but just that we could work with this thing. And James's work is really fascinating because with his brushstrokes, it's about this full gesture, this human body. Yet when you actually see one, you can't quite understand how it got there. How can it exist like that? Because it doesn't look like a person made it. It looks like it was a snapshot or a photograph that just got that exists in time and space. And I'm always often trying to unwind them and try to figure out how could it exist in space, this thing that's so dimensional. And if you're familiar with his film work or his music, some of his sculpture, early work from the 70s, it all has this amazing connection through it. And even this work somehow, even though there was zero intention to connect it to anything, it actually looks like one of the brushstrokes dissected and the curves that exist in one of those brought out and put there, even though that wasn't his intention, I don't think, or certainly ours. And the way that you can find that, even when you're trying to get away, it's still connected. So
for you, when you look at this body of work, are you surprised at all at the end result?
I'm usually surprised because it never comes out quite how I first imagined it. The brushstrokes, the prints of the brushstrokes that JP has made are amazing. It's like we photograph them however many times for each color and overexpose the first one and then expose the next one a little, the next screen a little more, a little less, and then a little less. So the screens, the information on each screen becomes reduced. And then we print it in reverse with the bleached out silhouette of the brushstroke in a very muted version of the color we're using. And then the next screen is a little bit darker, a little less information, and so on until we kind of build it up. It's like we sliced that brushstroke microscopically thin and then reconstituted it. And it was a brilliant solution because we didn't want to make like a half-tone image of a brushstroke. And when you look at these at those prints, you really can't see how it was made. You think that about my brushstrokes, I think that about your prints.
Yeah, the brushstrokes are interesting because in a way we are trying to keep the dynamic of the paintings, not trying to reproduce them, but keep what the space that's in them, the depth and the highlights that are in them. But one thing you're able to do once you have the set of screens is you can sort of shift the contrast of the whole thing. You can start light, and end up really dark. You could actually start darker and then don't let it get dark so quickly. So you can actually play with the range, which James could do from painting to painting by mixing different paint. But here we can actually take the same image and express it in completely different ways. We always have this thing, did we start too light? You don't really know what the thing's going to look like until you finish. So it's a really wonderful thing that you can play with, because you think it's sort of predetermined, but there's an amazing amount of room to change it.
So for you as an artist, when you approach that part of that kind of painting it or putting it back together, once it's been broken out into those pieces, what for you are you looking for as far as that response that this is working? Because there's that moment in all printing processes where you think it might not work, and then there's that moment where it starts to transition into something that's interesting. And so in a process where you can have this sort of theme and variations, where you have all those screens and you can infinitely vary the colors, what sort of feedback are you looking for to know that you're on the right track?
Well, it's a very intuitive process. And if JP suggests something, I usually will consider it and go for it, because his suggestions are always really good. You're right, there's always a point where you're not sure if something is working, and it may be a problem with the color, or the elements in my prints are few, but if one of them is off, the whole thing falls apart. So it's a matter of deciphering the part that is not working and doing something about it. Sometimes we just put the print up unfinished at the end of the day and come back the next day and look at it with fresh eyes if there's if it's not working for some reason.
I think that's something I would definitely like to stress as a printer myself, is that what you all get in the end is the thing that has worked. And there's a lot of not working in those days in between. And I think for me as a printer, and I'm curious your perspective, that's one of my favorite yet most frustrating places to be. And I wonder if there was points within this particular project where there was that sort of not working frustration that kind of helped you get through to something that was going to work.
I mean, I think on this project, we had experimented actually with the high-speed drawings on James' machine on acetate and made screen prints. And they were not so successful. They were for a moment, and then maybe we overworked them, and then we just shelved it. And
they actually, there was a technical problem with touching the acetate.
Exactly.
The ink wouldn't stick, that kind of thing.
Yeah. We had actually worked through some of what you're talking about with a completely different print and a completely different process. And so by the time we got to this, we had a little bit more of a direct idea of what we were going to do. In the first project, we really wanted to just express all the angles or the arcs as a very formal set and not play around too much with color, because we had made proofs where we put multicolors in the plates, and they're also exquisite prints, but we just thought we're going to start here because we have the cones now. They're devices that can be used over and over to make these drawings or paintings or even acetates.
Yeah, quite often, I would say almost always, for the prints we make, there's a period of needing to, of preparation, building something, or there's always like color mixing and that kind of thing. But once the plan has been made, then that's taken care of, and we just have to do it. But in another sense, it's like beginning all over again, because the whole thing is wide open at that point. And we're always I mean, we make pretty radical changes to a project while we're working on it also. Mm. It's with open minds that we approach the actual making of the print once the structure, everything is set up to do it, I would say.
I mean, it's also that, as Phil was explaining earlier in the discussion about the different things, when you're working with a publisher, or he outlined a little bit about what a publisher does, and there's a huge group of people that can be involved in this stuff. Some shops are small, and you could intimately work with an etcher who's doing all the processing and all the plate making and make the prints in their studio. Or you have a publisher, so Ann Marshall, my wife and partner, are conceiving, you know, what it is that we're going to do and how complex it's going to be and how big of a project it's going to be. And then we devise some sort of system for making something. And then we get to the point that James was just mentioning, where you now are going to produce the project. And then you have, you know, in our case, 4 and 5 printers also working on all this at the same time. So it's an amazing amount of energy that it takes to put all this together and to actually execute it and to make it easy, to make it flow and move.
You want to give people a concept of how much developmental time was to get to that point where you had plates to work with?
This was probably 6 to 9 months, something like that. So it's from the starting of the cones. The plates are actually made by a photogravure plate maker named Paul Taylor. So we had to get the work scanned, and then he had to make the plates, and then steel face them, crop them into these shapes, and then proof them. So it's quite a process, quite a long time.
Right, so the thing that I like to highlight in that is the level of faith that's required that it's gonna work. And that you, as a publisher, you have to believe so much more so in the work, because it's your time and your effort and your facility and your money to produce this work. So that way, when it gets out into the world, it's something that, as a publisher, you're proud to represent and you believe is a full realization of your artist's vision.
Definitely. I mean, you have to have a very deep commitment to what it is you're making and believe it's the right thing and that it's better than the other thing you were thinking about. And because a lot of times you're just getting to a proof, but then you have to actually make the production. We're working on a print now that's, you know, it's been 4 or 5 straight months of printing with 3-4 people. So time you get to the end of that, you have so much in it, you have to believe it, and you have to get it right from the beginning. So it's pretty intense. Belief, I think. Faith.
Right. Faith is what it is. Borderline crazy.
Yeah, borderline crazy.
And one of the things that I like to talk about, too, is that you're making work that is a multiple and will exist over time. And so when you come to a fair like this and say you go to a booth that has old masterwork, there was a publisher at some point in that arc that had to have that faith to produce that work that is now still out there, changing hands and living its life across space and time. Right. And as a publisher, in the back of your mind, there's the money, there's the making sure the artist is happy, but there's also this small aspect of how it fits into that longer arc of time and where its voice will fall over that period of time. And so how this fits within the canon of history. So if you're thinking about this print being sold by a secondary market dealer in 100 years from now, where would that land and where would that fit? And most of the time, printers aren't really focused on that when they're in production. But have you reflected upon that at all with this project? No, it's kind of behind you a little bit.
Well, I mean, I do with all the projects. Maybe the best way to express it is an artist can make a drawing, and it could be an okay drawing, but it can exist as a drawing and be somewhere. But when you're making a print, whether you're making 20, 40, or 50 of them, it's a much bigger thing to have out there in the world. So if you misstep with a drawing, it's just an okay drawing. If you misstep with a print, you have 50 prints that you may hate later. So you really want to be thinking about that when you're making it. Like, is this it? Do you feel really committed to it? Because you're about to send these out into the world, both for the artist and for the publisher, that they have to live with this rash decision they made about this color. And then all of a sudden you think, like, in other words, do you really want to do it? Does it really matter? So in a way, a print can kind of quantify that commitment more, because it's 50 things that you have to look after. Whereas one bad drawing is just one bad drawing. It's not it's like was an experiment. It's something you work through. But by the time you get to the print, you should be feeling a little more committed than that, I would imagine. But at least
we work well together, and sometimes we just hit a brick wall, and it's not happening, and we can let it go. That's happened a couple of times. I don't think we ever put out something which we feel really bad about. I'm glad to say. There's a kind of back and forth the whole time while we're making a print. There's trading of ideas and a lot of discussion.
I mean, so far, this project has gotten stronger for me since we made it. And it's a very succinct beginning of the possibility of working with this language more. We're already working on 8 new larger plates. So, you know, it was successful in that way, you know.
Right, as a wonderful jumping off point. I mean, one of the things that I take anecdotally from what you're saying is this willingness to let something drop that's not right. And I think something really to highlight is that dedication to getting everything just right from a conceptual and visual perspective as well as a technical perspective, because this is your voice and vision in the world, and that you want what you have to say to be as clear as possible, to communicate it as clearly as possible, so that way an audience, when they receive that work, they know that this is what you intended.
We usually find the finishing point by, we're always in agreement, I find, when we're working together. I mean, most of the time, it's like let's go here, yeah, let's go there. You know, we just kind of move along. I think I forgot your question.
It seems as though you two have developed quite a wonderful shorthand.
Yeah, we've got a good working.
It's where you can say a lot without having to say much when it comes to the work, and it's a enviable position, I think, for a lot of artists to be in, to have someone that they can trust to that level and knows that when something's not working without even necessarily having to say it, tell by body language, and that you both know that you won't let anything out into the world that's not right. And I think that's a really key thing to express to an audience, is that if it goes out the door, it's right.
Yeah.
I think if you're not working well together, the chances of getting a good print are small.
Yeah.
It really just, you know, you need that. You need that agreement on where you're going.
I mean, I think we're also lucky because my wife and partner can also come back to the studio after we've done all our nonsense and look at it with fresh eyes and think, you know, what have we really been up to? So when somebody sees it and you forget about all the technical nonsense and what you're doing and how hard it is to make, just to think about it as an artwork, period, you know, and it's very helpful to have people that can kind of give you a second. I mean, you have to believe yourself, but it's helpful to have a kind of a...
And everybody working in the print shop has knowledge. And I tend to encourage people to, you know, to talk about it. And sometimes they might have a suggestion or say, you can't do that. So it's a big collaboration. But it's always a nice moment at the end of the day when Anne comes down and sees the thing, what we've been up to, with those fresh eyes.
So for you guys, how much do you like to let other people in on what you're working on as far as outside feedback? Do you keep it pretty close into the shop environment, or is it something that you really open up that collaborative process to others to witness?
Well, I mean, for me, it's very dependent on the artist, always, how they want to work with whoever's in the shop. Some really embrace it and know how to control the shop and use all the printers in a very creative way. It's actually kind of amazing. And others have more of a focus, and we have a plan and there's an idea, but it's kind of amazing. You know, even then somebody will say something and you'll think, oh my God, it happened recently and it was kind of a big change in what we were doing. We shifted from making two small things to one large thing and one small thing, almost by accident, because two things were pinned on the wall close to each other. So it really depends, and it's incredible. incredibly great when an art, it's really great when an artist is open to the whole studio because they get to use everybody there. There's this, all this hidden horsepower besides the equipment and the ink. It's all these other ideas. And so if they keep it close to themselves, they might miss this other opportunity. So as James was saying, he's always very welcoming of what other people think. And it's either going to back what you think up or it's going to go against it. And then you'll, if you have weak knees, then you might realize that they might be right or there might be an idea. So
People, you have visitors that come by the studio when we're working sometimes, but it doesn't, we're not plumbing their minds for any help. We just work away. People come by.
So what do you want to challenge him with next? You got anything you're cooking
up? I do, but I'm keeping it close. I do have a couple of ideas. I always have ideas, too many ideas, but there are several things. I'm not going to say what I'm going to do because it never comes out like that anyway.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
It's kind of a losing thing.
But the thing to point out is that there is always something cooking, and I think
yes.
From a collaboration perspective, it's that once you've created that trust and that bond in the studio, there's always something brewing. There's always something cooking, and it's that's part of that joy of printing as collaborating printers, that we get into this space where we have a lot of artists that we work with, but we're constantly thinking about what's good for each one of them. And I think something to really stress, especially with what JP's done with Durham, is each artist's work is their own work. And I think that's really important to point out. It's not his vision that he's trying to satisfy, it's that you're really trying to help your artists satisfy their creative vision. And I think it's evident in the work that you can see that these are distinct artists' visions. It's not like a shop aesthetic and everything has to be a certain way. And I think it's, there's something maybe for you to talk about what drives you as a printer to really be involved in so many different ways of seeing the world with the artists that you work with.
Oh, it's a good question. I suppose there's probably some deep psychology there that I don't want to get into, but I don't know. I love to make things just first and foremost. And as I said before, printmaking just happens to be the thing that's in the way of me making things. So I make it with printmaking, and I like working with people, and I like figuring out how we can make something that is both reflective of what they're doing, but also can use this medium in a way that they're not doing in the studio. Even when it looks similar, there's still other opportunities that happen. Because printmaking, because of its nature in breaking things down so much, which they don't often get to do in their studio, they have this ability to make something from their work, but expressed in a completely different way. And it's a challenge to collaborate, to be help the technical things. You just assume you have to do that part. That's a job that you're doing. You have to be able to put a print together, register it, mix color, match color, come up with ideas. And then the creative part, you're always flirting with sort of, you want to be them and give ideas that would come from them. So you don't want to overstep, but you also want to push overstepping because then it helps them maybe to try something else. So it's...
You can see when it goes wrong and back it up a bit.
Yeah. One of the things as a collaborating printer myself that I always like to start at is that I always say to an artist, if you can do it in your studio, do it in your studio. There's really no point in us doing that in the print shop. It's that problem that you can't solve in your studio that makes it interesting and engaging for all of us. And it seems like you like to bring him a lot of problems to solve from your studio.
I know that it's difficult to translate some of my ideas into an actual object, but JP is very precise. The prints are, in a way, Durham Press prints, and your creative input, there's a kind of precision about the work we do together, which I really like. It's got to be just right, and we work very hard to get that.
All right, so the sense that I get from the two of you is that the goal that's in common is is to make a work of art first that happens to be a print, so that the viewer, when they come up to it, they're really focused on it as a work of art. And the first thing that they're thinking about is, what is this thing I'm looking at? And, you know, what is it doing for me conceptually and visually? And they get to the fact that it's a print two or three questions down the line. It's not, you don't want someone walking up going, that's a great etching, because that may not be what you're really going for. What you're really going for is that work of art first that happens to be a print. And it seems like that's what you're going for, and that's what you're going for, and one of the reasons the work that you produce is so successful.
It's a whole different mindset for the artist. You have to really see things with fresh eyes, because, like you said, you're in the print shop, you can do things which you can't do in the studio. And you just have to find out what those things are. And a lot of that comes from the expertise of the people around you. And it's an improvisation.
I mean, most of the work that we make is made from nothing. I mean, virtually once in a while an artist comes with a drawing. Sometimes it comes with a very solid idea, but generally we're working from scratch. So I'm only thinking about making an artwork. It does happen to be a print, and then you do addition it, which then takes it further into the print world. But because of my past experience in printmaking, that's what always informed me, was to do that first, to try to make something that is an artwork, and then work around the print thing after that, basically, you know.
Well, we have a limited amount of time left, but I wanted to know if there were any questions out there.
You know, basically somebody that you just said no.
I think I've had a couple that's been difficult.
This looks like a great relationship and all that, but I'm sure you must have run into things that weren't so.
Yeah, I hear stories.
No, I've had a few occasions where you've made a print and it's actually a reasonably successful print, at least visually, maybe not financially. But the relationship just doesn't go anywhere, kind of thing. And maybe that is, in fact, what it is. I've never had a horrible experience, not that I can remember, but some of them just don't flourish. You just don't have, because it's a language that you're in, a trust that you're trying to develop, and it takes years. A lot of our earlier projects aren't successful at all, and it's only on the second or the third one that you actually get any traction whatsoever. So we're talking about years of working before you're seeing any real return. So that takes a little bit of a magical relationship, or at least a friendship or something.
Yeah, I always know that, like, you've been thinking about the print. I'll come for a couple of days and then come back to the city, and it might be a couple of weeks before I return to the print shop. But you've always been thinking about it, and it's like, a, you know, we just sort of start all over again when next time I show up. I was thinking we could do this. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, I mean, just to touch on that a little bit as a printer myself, because it is a relationship, you don't necessarily click or get along with everyone. And just because you and your temperament may not pair well with that artist doesn't mean there's another printer that wouldn't be a wonderful working relationship with. So, yeah, I think we kind of avoid a lot of those problems in the front end by exhaustive studio visits, a lot of time spent with one another to determine if, you know, we as printers have something to offer that person's work. So people ask me all the time, well, who are you thinking about working with that you maybe haven't worked with before? And I always go back to the point of, do I have something to contribute to that person's work? Do I feel that I can help them further their vision in some way that would be beneficial to them? So that's where we are as printers and as publishers. What we're thinking about is, do I have something to offer? And so we generally vet out a lot of problems just in that beginning process, because we want to make something that hasn't existed yet and that has a reason for being, and to be able to create that back and forth relationship with one another. That's what's really important, and special. I know it's something that I struggle with. We spend a lot of time in studios and talking to people.
Yeah, I've worked with other printers too, and it's always, you have to feel right from the beginning that you could work with this guy or this person. And if it's not right, I just won't work.
Does he work here? Do you have a favorite print that you've done over the years? Yeah.
I have some favorites. And yeah, I do. I can't. I mean, you know, there's the red one. Well, I made a pair of brush strokes, one in traffic light red and the other in traffic light green, one vertical and one horizontal, and they were called stop and go. But the red one was go and the green one was stop. Someone told me that in China the traffic lights were the other way around, so thinking about that, I titled them that way, and then I heard that that wasn't true. But I still like the titles. They're just, you know, a sort of back to front world. But we've made some beautiful prints. You just, at the end of the day, we always put something up on the wall and look at it. And sometimes you just want to look at it for a long time. A lot of surprises over the course of making a particular print, always.
Right, and I've found that if the artist wants to look at it for a long time, you probably will too. If it can capture them in that way where they get lost within their own work and it's their world that they've created, and that means that you'll get that opportunity to see the world through their eyes. And so as a printer, that's what I look for, is that point of pause in my artist that I'm collaborating with, so that I know that this is their world truly and as best as we can achieve it. Because if they don't want to stare at it, there's no reason for anyone else to.
Thank you for being here. This is a little off topic for this discussion, but James, I was just curious how it felt for you to put together the retrospective that just closed at the Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I had such fun doing that.
Did you?
We planned that for 6 years, and they installed, we had, for the first time ever, you know, I have a broad range of interests. We had my film, we had like 32 films installed, and there was a separate film program on Sundays. We had paintings, sculptures, objects, photos, drawings. It was materially like a very varied show, but the threads, I think, were strong. And I really, really enjoyed putting it together. And working with Marcel Poldnick, the director of the museum, who is a very special person. Well, it all made sense, which was pretty nice to see. It was like, so yeah, this makes sense. You know, my life hasn't been a total red herring or something, but yeah, there are lots of things that I saw and. Lots of ideas. The older I get, the more ideas I have. It's really like an affliction of sorts.
We just want to say thank you all for coming, and I encourage you to take some time to head over to Durham's booth and see this work in person for yourself, because it is on exhibit here in the fair. And please ask questions of the people in the booths, because every print on that wall has a backstory of its creation and production, just like this one particular project has. So when you think of a fair of this scale, it's this amount of love and dedication towards the vision of an artist being fulfilled that has produced the work that is here. So I encourage you to take the time to look slowly and ask a lot of questions, because there's a lot of knowledge and information that comes with it too. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. The Printcast brings you interviews with some of the best contemporary printmakers, sharing anecdotes, business ideas, and technical tips with listeners everywhere. It's like print porn for your ears. If you like what you are listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review on iTunes, and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find The Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play, as well as online at theprintcast.com. Music for this special edition is by Broke for Free. Voiceover, editing, and production provided by your host, Nick Naughton. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you on another episode of the Printcast. Bye for now.